As many of you see today, and as you have experienced earlier, this is probably one of the most problematic and difficult chapters to really understand on a deep level, and I worked on it for many, many, many hours, and I'm not convinced that you're going to walk out of this room feeling better about it, but at least you are going to be familiar. You're not the first ones to think of these questions, and at least you will be familiar with some of the approaches to dealing with this question. Now, obviously, we have to approach this from two different perspectives. The main perspective is we have to ask our question about God. And the question about God is, how could God, who is moral, who is all good, who is the, source of all goodness in the world, how could he ask Abraham to do something that seems to be so, and let's use the word, immoral, the taking the life of somebody else? It seems to us to be absurd. It seems to be unethical. It seems to be cruel. It seems to be inconsistent. It seems to be, okay, so that's going to, so we're going to come to, that is going to be one of the things we have to look at. But just as terms of the reader and as readers who Torah is written, B'lashon B'nei Adam, it was given to us as humans, and we have to try to understand it with our human mind. So that is obviously the question they're going to be dealing with on one. And the second perspective is many of you are also troubled by the moral behavior of Avraham. Avraham does not argue, and we know that in the halacha, that if you do something wrong and you say, well, they made me do it, that doesn't make it better. So even if they made me do it is God, Avraham perhaps should have turned around and said, sorry, can't do that. Okay? So that we have to sort of try to understand Avraham's behavior here as well. Why does Avraham willing to go through this as well? Now, right, and to make the question stronger, is even when he thought that God was doing something immoral by killing out the tzaddik and Rasha in Sodom, Avram said to him, "Hashofet kal haaretz lo ya'aseh mishpat." Is it possible that God is going to do something unjust? And Avram refused to accept that then. Okay, so we're going to get to the answers momentarily. Let's first just make sure that we have clarified the question. And I'm going to present, I think, about 8 to 10 different answers over the next hour. I like to say that they first made Aliyah. There used to be this radio program that I used to like to listen to. And it would be a call-in show. And the guy would ask a question about the Parsha. And the people would call in answers. And the guy would say, 7. He rated out of 10. So one time this guy called up and he asks the question, the guy gives the answer, and the guy says to him, 7. And the caller goes, what do you mean 7? It's the Rabban. And the guy says, I don't care who it is, it's still a 7. So that's what I say. We're going to present a whole bunch of different answers, and each of you, where you are going to have to sort of rate this answer where it is on the list of, and maybe combine some of the answers to find the answer that works for you. Now, just to make the situation even stronger, I want to remind you of source number one. Source number one, I think, is a story that you're all familiar with. And it's the story that Avraham is on his way to the Akedah. And who does he meet? Who does he meet on the way to the Akedah? Samuel. Who is Samuel? That's another name for Satan. He meets the Satan. And the Satan says to him, old man, says the devil to Avraham, are you out of senses? Are you going to slaughter a son born to you in the age of 100? We're used to the Satan playing which role?
Evil.
The Satan is usually the evil guy. And here in this Midrash, we're putting the moral argument into the mouth of the Satan. To understand the irony of this Midrash is which personality is chosen in order to show Avraham how immoral this is, the what we would view as the king of immorality. We would view the Satan as such, and he says to him, what are you going to slaughter a son born to you at the age of 100? Avram doesn't argue, this argument failing. So he ridicules the pious obedience of the patriarch another way by saying to him, would you do perhaps even more for God than murder your son? Let's say God doesn't stop at this. Who knows what the next request is going to be? Can you even stand more? And only after all this argument fails does the devil advance his most devastating piece of skepticism and the most dangerous temptation by asking Avraham, will not God say to you tomorrow that you are a murderer? What happened? You follow God, and the next day God turns around to you and says, murderer, you have murdered your son. You are guilty. So in other words, what's this Midrash really doing? Did Avram and the Satan, and then you know that Midrash goes further. What happened? Midrash goes further that the Satan turns himself into a river, and until Avram gets up to Avraham's neck, and then Avram finally turns to God and says, you want me to do this? It has become accepted in today's biblical approaches that the Satan and the Satan turning himself into the water really represents what? The conscience. That's right. It presents the conscience of Avraham. That it is, although it's interesting that it's put into the negative characteristic here of Satan, but we already see that here too. We're looking at it as, by putting it into the mouth of the Satan, I think the Midrash is actually saying to us that it's like a self-evident question here. That even the Satan comes to Avram and says, how can you do this? So, approach number one is one that I call the happy ending approach. The happy ending approach is one where we can't look at any part of Torah as just a couple of verses. We have to look at the story in its entirety like we did last week. And here, when we look at it in the entirety, so one of the first things we notice is the introductory sentence. The introductory sentence, Vayehi achar hadvarim ha'elo ve'Elokim nisa et Avraham. That term is given to you as a reader so that before you come into anything else, you already know that this whole thing is just being a test. It's a setup that it never has any intention in going through with it, and that is how you're supposed to go into this idea. Taking it even a step further in this idea, if some of you notice that there are certain questions about their language in the chapter that indicates that God never expected Avraham to go through with this. What are some of those words in the chapter?
Lech lecha, it's like a repetition.
Okay, so the lech lecha, and I say, unfortunately, we do not have a chance to really, to do this parak properly would probably take us a couple of months. And I can't go into all the nuances of the chapter, but the comparison of the first lech lecha and the last lech lecha is fascinating. But that does, I don't think that necessarily tells us that he's not going to go through with it, because the first lech lecha he did. Okay, pasuk hey says nishtachave v'nashuva, and we will return. Now, there is a argument by Rev Elimelech Milizinsk, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And Rabbi Elimelech says that Avraham and Yitzchak both knew it wasn't going to happen.
Did Yitzchak think it was going to happen?
Now, how does, one second, if that is indeed the true, how does that change our whole understanding of the story? Correct. Right, so that's the problem. The problem with this approach is it's very nice and makes us feel really good and everything. But when you think about it for a minute, it reduces the whole concept of test, and then why should...
Even this whole concept of test, it seems to me that Avraham has been through so much, done so much, I mean, when it says here that God knows now, it says
now I know.
Didn't he know it before?
Okay, like, that is a problem. That is a right. Which also, which I think adds to our question. Now I know. But if there was no test, what do you mean? Now I know. And as many of you are familiar with, God tested Abraham with 10 tests, with this being the 10th.
So that pursuit is why murdering your son
proves that you that's correct. God. So that's what we're going to something's answer some. It answers one question, opens up another one, but that's the approach of Rev Elimelech. Now, if you look at source 9 and 10, source 9 and 10. You'll notice, first of all, in source 9, I brought you two psukim from Yirmiyahu that are seemingly identical. One appears in Yirmiyahu 7, and the other appears in Yirmiyahu 19. And it talks about that the people built high places of Baal, Baal is the Avodah Zarah, to burn their children with fire, as burnt offering to the Baal. Now here comes the key sentence. Which I did not command, neither did I speak, nor did it enter my mind. Three expressions that God is completely rejecting child sacrifice. I don't want it. I'm not interested. So if you look at Rashi in Source 10, this is the Rashi in Yirmiyahu. Rashi says, which I did not ordain, with commandments that they offer up their child to sacrifice. God says, I never asked it, nor did I speak to it of any prophets. And when I did speak to Abraham to slaughter its son, it did not enter my mind that he slaughter, but only to make his righteousness known. Yafet, 1 second. So if you move down to number 11, source number 11, source number 11 is the Gemara in Ta'anit. The Gemara in Ta'anit reads as follows. V'ketiv b'Yirmiyahu, and he brings the first source over here in Yirmiyahu. Asher lo tziviv v'lo dibarti v'lo ata alta alibi. Now, asher lo tziviti zeb b'no shel Mesha Melech Moav. I never commanded. That's the son of Mesha Melech Moav. Now, those of you who have been studying with me for a while, we did this 2 summers ago. Okay, when we talked about the Mesha steel, do you remember? So at the end of that perek in Mesha, which in Melachim Bet Perek Yugimel, it says, "Vayikachet b'no ha'bechor asher imloch tachtav v'yalehu ola." Okay, the king of Moab, Mesha, brings him up as a sacrifice. And we had a whose son it was, that was a whole discussion. But the first thing the Gemara in Tanit says, then when it says in the Pasuk, asher lo tziviti, that means Mesha Melech Moab. Velo dibarti ze yiftach. Velo dibarti ze yiftach. What's the Gemara referring to? What happened to Yiftach's daughter? Remember, it's unclear in the chapter there what indeed happened to her. But here, according to the Gemara, he actually did sacrifice her. And the Gemara is saying, I don't want it. I don't need it. V'lo alta alibi, and I never even occurred to me, refers to Yitzchak ben Avraham. So what is this pasuk? What are these? What's this establishing here? Again, this is establishing that God never intended to bring Yitzchak as a sacrifice. And from the beginning, it's a nisayon, and the reader knows this, unfortunately, Abraham does not know that. And how does that change it? That's right. It still leaves that question in place. Okay? And if you look at source number 12, the Midrash picks up on this as well. Actually, we can see it in 11. Let's do 11 and 12. 11 says the same thing in English. For those of you who the Ta'anit was in Hebrew, 11 is the same thing in English. I never decreed. It's Mesha Melech Moav. Yiftach and Avraham. Source number 12 is the Bereshit Rabbah. The Bereshit Rabbah says, Avraham could have said, recently you told me, in Yitzchak shall be your seed. Right? God had told Avraham in the chapter, 2 chapters beforehand, Yitzchak will be the one to inherit you. And then later you come along and say, now take your son. It's an outright contradiction. And you tell me to stay, and now you tell me to take my son, and now you tell me not to kill him. God is made to reply in the words of Tehillim 79, verse 35, "My covenant will I not profane." God says, "No, I never changed my mind, nor alter which has gone out of my lips. And I don't change my words off. When I said to you, take your son, I was not altering that which came out of my lips, the promise that the sentence was come from Yitzchak, because I did not say to you, slay him, but I said, bring him up. I said, bring him up. You brought him up. Now, take him down." So that therefore, again, all of these answers are coming with this idea that there was never the intention of God to, and by the way, this Vahaleihu, you see, appears in Pasuk Beth. God says to him, take your son, the only son that you love, and God doesn't say bring him as a sacrifice. God doesn't say kill him. God says Vahaleihu sham le'ola, and offer him as a offering. And the Medrash is saying that's exactly what God did. Now, this doesn't sit well with a number of you because
it's very misleading.
It's misleading.
We're never told in court.
We're never
in court. I don't like it.
You know, it reminds me also like almost like of those like kids who like don't do their homework, and she says, "CM, do you do your homework?" And you say, "Yeah, 3 weeks ago." Right back. Right. It's the sort of like, as you say, it's like evasive. It's
but it says bring him up from burnt offering.
That's the English. The English says bring him up as a burnt offering. The Hebrew, right, everybody assumes valei la'ola, ola means sacrifice.
Well, actually, it's very good. But at this point, Isaac asked him about the sacrifice, and he said,
a lamb. Yeah, sorry, okay.
So understand that you call, say, I call this answer one, and I'm actually going to come back to it at the end, but it's the probably the simplest of the explanations, because it sort of, you know, clears everything up, you know, God never meant to, and it was, but it really doesn't get to the depth of the problem. It does, it sort of skirts around the idea, say, well, God never really said that. But Avram understood it that way.
I once learned, and I don't remember the source, years ago, that God didn't.
I'm going to get to that. I'm going to come to that. That's an answer we're going to get to a little later. Right. It doesn't, and clearly that doesn't answer our question for Avram as well. So let's move on.
If he did know, then it goes back to the situation
that there's no test, right? If Avram was just playing along, that's right, then it's meaningless. All right, let's move on to answer number two. Answer number two, that what is morality? Is something moral because God commanded it? Or does God command it because it is moral? Is it moral because God commanded it? Or does God command it because it's moral? So in this situation, what the approach would say is morality is defined by what God says. And that if God says, take your son and offer him as a burnt offering, today, that is morality. Now, on what, and you have this, by the way, in a very strong position in source number three. Source number three is Rav Shlomo Aviner. And in source number three, he says, and I apologize for the Hebrew, but his stuff hasn't been translated yet. In source number three, Rav Aviner says, Hatzav ha'eloki la'akod et Yitzchak, the divine commandment to sacrifice Yitzchak, memutat et kol asher yada Avraham b'chayav, goes against everything that Avraham led his life, that kol asher limed acherim, and not only how he led his life, but also how he taught others. L'lamed chesed u'mishpat. That's what Avraham did. Hakedah hi akedat hamusar ha'enoshi. What the akedah does is the akedah sacrifices human morality. And in place of human morality, it places God's command. Lilamedcha, to teach you, bitsura hadratit biyoter, to teach you in the most dramatic way, shet mitzvat Hashem, and then, oh, that's something will come, enenu mekaimim mipnei shekach tov lanu. We don't keep God's rule because it's good for us, and it makes sense to us. Mipnei shanu mivinim oto, or because we understand it, or mipnei shanu margishim noam bekaima, or because we feel good about it. We keep kashrut because it's healthy for us. No! Ella mipnei shehi mitzvat Hashem. We keep the mitzvot because God said so. V'hatzav lo tirtzach, and the mitzvah of do not kill, kehora'ah musarit enoshit meit. And the reason that you say, God said don't kill, the reason we don't kill is not because it's morally incorrect to kill. The reason we don't kill is because God told us not to kill. And the reason we have these rules is not because man thinks so, but this is because God said so. Okay? Now, on one hand, this is a approach. What does it answer?
Blind faith.
It's really blind faith, capital B, capital F. It gets rid of the moral question. Why does it get rid of the moral question?
Because
anything God says is moral, and I'm going to come back to that point in a minute. What's the problem with it? Why aren't you all saying, okay, we're happy, let's go home?
Because it's not moral.
He said, thou shalt not kill.
So that's right. God, and if God says you should kill, so then you should kill. That's exactly what this opinion says. That's exactly what the opinion says. If God says kill, kill. God says don't kill, don't kill. It doesn't matter whether it makes sense to you or not. Yeah, so you have free choice not to listen to him, but still that doesn't reflect on it.
If you look at the mother,
okay, we're going to get to that in Bishalach. We're going to talk about that. Michiat Amalek is a problem we are going to do here in class together. But I'm waiting for someone to tell me what is the real problem with this approach.
Is what the common morality of the child.
I'm going to come to that answer. Hold on. Go ahead. We're going to talk about that. Go ahead.
This is morality is absolute. There's no question. You don't ever have to question anything because either there's a commandment to do it or there's a commandment not to do it.
There are no two ways about it.
And maybe it was even easy.
Whether you're going to listen.
Hashem spoke directly. Hashem comes here. We accept that there's certain things that God spoke to Abraham or spoke to prophets there. You've got some crazy person who believes that God spoke to him. How are you going to argue with
okay, that is one of the problems with this approach. One of the problems with this approach is that it justifies anything. All you have to do is show up and say, God said so. And that's what happens today. We are experiencing, that's right, we are experiencing that as well. So that is the problem with this. But let's try to analyze it deeper. The reason so many of us have a problem with that, and the reason we have a problem with somebody saying, well, God said so, is because we do believe that God blessed us with a tselem Elokim, which means that having blessed me with Tselem Elokim means that I do have ability to decide between
good
and bad. And that I can look at murder as being bad. Okay? And so that even if God doesn't come along and tell me murder is bad, and we spoke about this, when Cain kills Hevel, and God says to Cain, "Why? Where is your brother?" Cain does not say, "Oh, okay, well then what's wrong with that?"
And God holds him responsible because God expects humans to know that killing is wrong. Okay, so that is the problem with this approach.
Why do we need the commandments?
So then why do we need the commandments? And what is the purpose of the commandments? So you understand what we're hitting on here is a. It's interesting. This is this answer of saying that if God commanded it, makes it moral, is an answer. It explains that the purpose of mitzvot. We assume, by the way, the halacha says, what difference does it make to God if I kill the animal here or I kill the animal here? What does God care? Because the purpose of mitzvot are to make us better people. It's Tzareif Bahem et HaBriot. And if we're not becoming better people for the mitzvot, then why did God commit it? So that is something we're going to talk about, you know, later on in the year, where does morality come from? But I just want you to understand this approach. If you look at source number two, here is ironic in a way because it is written by Rav Kalmanis Shapiro, the Eish Kodesh. Does anybody know who he was or what happened to him? He was in the Warsaw Ghetto, and he died in the Warsaw Ghetto. Okay, and his writings were discovered after the war. And so I don't know at what point he wrote this piece, but he writes like this: the nations of the world, even the best of them, think that truth is a thing in itself, and that God commanded truth because truth is intrinsically true. Right? That's right, that there's a certain accepted good and bad. Not so, Israel. Who say, when we say you, God, are truth, and we have no truth besides him, and all the truth found in the world is there only because God wished it and commanded it? Stealing is forbidden because the God of truth has commanded it. And so when God ordered Avram to sacrifice his son Isaac, it was true to sacrifice him, and had God not said later, neither do anything to him, it would have been true to slaughter him. This is the extreme position of, right? Answer number one was happy ending. Answer number two is, morality becomes what God says, and therefore if God says kill, that becomes moral. Now in the Gush, Rabbi Bick has an article where he takes this idea, and I thought he takes it in an interesting twist. He says like this, he says, God is good. Everything God commands is good. God commands you to kill your son. What is the test of Avraham? The test of Avraham is to somehow take that command of God and intellectually understand it as good. And I was trying to understand how that could be. So he says that Avraham's test is to find the Musar in this new command of God. So I was thinking to myself, is there ever a time where killing somebody might be moral?
Defending yourself.
Right, that becomes the obvious thing. If somebody comes to kill you, and you kill them, you have killed them, you have taken the life, but you are saving your own life, everybody here would agree that you are doing, well, 90% of the world would begin that you are saying the right thing. So there is a point where you could justify murder.
There's lots of times in the Tanakh when the nations are commanded to go and wipe out an entire, Israel's commanded to wipe out an entire population, not just the soldiers, women, children. So therefore, it's very hard for us to deal with it.
That's right, but if you are a terrorist who is building a tunnel under a hospital, there, you know, that becomes a different rule of war than if you are a soldier. So that's one way. See, I'm just saying, we're trying to think of how you can take. I was thinking, perhaps, do you? You're old enough to remember that. I can't say this to my students. Do you remember the last MASH? MASH, the television show MASH. Do you remember the last one? Okay. In the last one, the last scene, they bring up a moral dilemma. There are a whole bunch of people hiding in a room, and a baby starts to cry. And the mother tries to hush the baby, and in the end the baby suffocates, in order to save the entire room of people. And this is called Zahavat HaTram, and that's what the show is. The question is, in such a situation, would you be able to say that the morally safe thing there to save the group is to get rid of one? I'm not sure. I'm just trying to think of ways that perhaps you could try to find ways to justify murder. There are plenty of people who will tell you that euthanasia, mercy killing, is the more moral position.
Well, the person wants to die.
Right. Well, let me give one last example. The last example I was thinking of, perhaps, you know that in the medieval ages, it was quite common that the Christians were coming, the pogrom was coming through, and what did some parents do? Parents killed their children rather than allow the children to be slaughtered, converted, taken as slaves, whatever it was that they were doing. Pardon? Masada. So now, do we view those murders as immoral?
At the worst, you could do as, you look at them as questionable. You can never judge somebody else.
Okay, so that's what I think Rabbi Bick is doing here. I think Rabbi Bick is doing there is he's taking this attitude of saying it's moral because God said so. And what he says is that what the challenge of Avraham is he has to somehow wrap his mind around how is it possible that murder could be morality. And that indeed is the test.
Is it really moral or it's just not immoral?
That's as far as he could get it. Okay, perhaps that's what it is.
Also, I'm having a look. You're saying good, but then you're saying justified. To me, I can't equate them in every situation. Just because something is justified
doesn't make it good. That's correct. I'm willing to. That's correct. That we should be. That's why I said we have to be careful with the language that we're using, and I accept that distinction. But this is approach number two. It's an approach. It also leaves some things unanswered. And I think question also this division of good from commandments is also something I think that's hard for many of us to live with. Now, we would never be...
Sorry, get. The example that you just gave about this, that it was Abraham's test to try to...
Find the morality, right.
To justify, figure out how this possibly could be moral or good. Are there any midrashim or anything from the text that hints that Abraham was even thinking in that direction?
Not that I know of, but I haven't searched all of the literature. Now, source number four is not a Jewish source. I mean, not source number four, answer number three is not a Jewish source, but it's one that we cannot talk about the morality of the Akedah without discussing, and that is the work of Kierkegaard. Okay, Kierkegaard wrote a whole book that you have here in source number five. The Night of Faith and the Night of Infinite Resignation. What Kierkegaard explains is something similar to this idea that we gave about the what God says is moral, but he takes it in a different direction. He says what happened here is God is asking Abraham to give up morality. And that morality has no value compared to the love of God. And what you have to do, what ordinarily tempts a man, I'm reading from 5, what ordinarily tempts a man is that which would keep him from doing his duty. But in this case, paradoxically, the ethical, the doing of one's duty, is itself the temptation. And more importantly, this is the key sentence, there must be a theological suspension of the ethical. Abraham suspended his obligation to the universal to fulfill the higher duty of God. This is not saying that God is asking him to do something moral, which was our answer number two. Answer number three, according to Kierkegaard, is that yes, God is asking him to do something unethical. That is correct.
That is the request that God is making from him. Because God is teaching humanity that there is a higher obligation, and that true religion, according to Kierkegaard, who is a Christian thinker, true religion means being able to suspend reason and moral consciousness when God demands it. And he gives the title to Avraham. He calls Avraham the knight of faith for his willingness to obey God and sacrifice his son. So in other words, Avraham suspends his own reasoning, which is something we saw. He listens to God with unwavering loyalty, whatever God says. Like when a kid does mischief and the kid says, well, my friend made me, and the parent always says, well, if he asked you to jump off the roof, would you? Right? This is a Kierkegaard saying, yes, yes. And finally, the third point that Kierkegaard makes is not only does he listen, not only disobey, but he never tries to explain. As opposed to Rabbi Bick, who said the whole idea is for him to try to find a rationalization, here Kierkegaard said, no, there's no rationalization. He never tries to justify it. He never tries to understand it. God says it, he does it. So in other words here, the moral hero, according to Kierkegaard, is somebody who sacrifices his own morality, his own inclinations, for something that he views to be more universal. Do we understand his approach? Yes. Do we agree with his approach? No. Okay. But it's important for us to understand, and they say he's got a whole book, you know, how heavy philosophy analyzing this approach.
However, when Avraham disagrees with something Hashem has decided by, like destroying Sodom and Gomorrah, he argues.
Right.
He doesn't argue here.
Okay. Right, and I think if you think about it, you'll see that there is quite a difference between the destroying of Sodom and you killing your own child. Mm-hmm. There's quite a difference there. That's right. Correct.
I think that this is very scary, because I think this was what the Nazis did in World War II.
Well, that's
they had their racist philosophy and all ethics.
Well, so let's. Which is that same idea of saying that God spoke to me. It's not that different. Which, by the way, let's take this. Let me throw out another thought, a question to you. I present this as the thought of Kierkegaard, and you'll see anybody who discusses the Akedah in any serious way will quote Kierkegaard. As religious Jews, how do we view Kierkegaard? And how do we view his approach? Okay, so it happens to be, as many of you have experienced already in the 2-3 classes that we've already had, you know that we're going to have some people who, and some people who don't agree. So that means the person who agrees most is actually Yeshayahu Leibowitz, Nechama's older brother. So Nechama's older brother, Yeshayahu, he comes along and says, based on Kierkegaard, that the Akedah becomes the paradigm of religious life. Now, he is unusual. He is unusual in the spectrum of Jewish thought, because generally, most Jews say that God says it is ethical. Again, it's important for me to get you to understand that according to Kierkegaard, he comes out and says that God is asking him to do something unethical. And that is the test. Now, many of you are familiar with the work of the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik. In his work, Halachic Man, okay, Rav Soloveitchik explains that it's not the same as Kierkegaard, but I think you might be able to say it's in the direction. He says that basically life is not about winning. He says religious life, religious life is a dialectic between victory and defeat, majesty and humility, man the master as opposed to man the obedient servant. There are times, and here comes the quote from the Rav, he says, that God tells man to withdraw from whatever man desires the most. God tells man to withdraw from what he desires the most. Thus, and that is what he says defeat. Defeat is when you just give in. So according to the Rav, Akedat Yitzchak is not actually a one-time experience, but it comes an example for the religious life. Whatever we want the most, whether it's eating, drinking, sexual activity, whatever it is, there's a point in time where the religious man has to step back and say, not now, asur. That's right. And even though we pride ourselves on reason, there comes a point where reason doesn't follow through. And so, according to the Rav, that it's not quite as extreme as Kierkegaard, but I think he's following in that direction by saying it is a giving in of what we want most. What did Abraham want most? His son. Now, this again is an approach. It's an accepted approach. I said even within Judaism to an extent. What's our problem with it?
It goes against what God already promised Abraham. It's not even just an issue of what Abraham wanted. It's an issue of what God has already promised him.
Okay. Let's even take it a step further. Milton Steinberg, name some of you recognize some of you, don't you? He says, what kind of business is that? You can't use it in answer by saying that God is asking you to do something unethical. He says, that is not an answer. Can God kill himself? No. But is there something God can't do? Why can't God kill himself? The problem is with the question. God can't kill himself because I'm asking him to do something that's logically impossible. Just the way God can't create a circle square because there is no such thing as a circle square, God cannot kill himself. Just the way God cannot kill himself, God cannot ask you to do anything immoral because God is all good. So that's why the rejection out of hand of Kierkegaard, because Kierkegaard is saying suspension of morality. And we say impossible. Impossible, and we cannot accept that God would ever ask us to suspend morality.
Again, if we believe that God spoke directly,
I'm going to get to that.
Face-to-face.
We're going to come with that in a minute. So far, we have happy ending.
Yeah.
So far, we can get through it. So far, we have happy ending. We have it becomes moral. And now it becomes a suspension of moral. The next answer I want to offer is the answer was alluded to before, is that perhaps what we're really talking about is different morality than we have today. In the time of Abraham, what was accepted morality? Child sacrifice was something that was well known. So that when God comes along and says to him, sacrifice your son, and look at source number 4. Maybe that'll also make it clearer. Source number 4 is a pasuk in Shmot. You have it in Hebrew and English. You have it Hebrew on one page, on English on the other. Bechor banecha titein li. Verse clearly says, the firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do likewise with your oxen and with your sheep. If you read just this verse, what does it sound like? It sounds like child sacrifice, correct? So you understand that perhaps that's where it was coming from. Perhaps before the giving of Torah, this was the thing to do. So when God says to him, do it, okay. Now, this also is, you hear this, people throw this answer around. Why don't you like this answer?
God asking them to do something that doesn't seem moral?
It still doesn't seem moral, even though everybody's doing it. But everybody's doing it doesn't make it moral.
Abraham, it seems like it's okay, maybe, but...
So that would explain to us perhaps why Abraham doesn't argue. That might explain that argument, but it doesn't explain to us, again, God's... Also, if morality is subjective, and morality changes, then...
There is no morality.
There is no morality, and then what's the purpose of mitzvot, and what's the purpose of commandments? And it puts to question everything that we live for. So by saying that things were different then doesn't necessarily answer the question.
Also, everything we've learned about Abraham so far is that he's different from everything that was and everyone at that
And time. We're supposed to use Abraham as a role model. Right. If Abraham's morality and his existence is different than mine, there goes my role model. So this brings me to answer number five. Answer number five is what I called the different message. That actually the purpose of the Akedah was to give us certain messages that we wouldn't get otherwise. And the first one is what you've mentioned already, which you have in source number six. Now, I was able to find some of it in Hebrew and some of it in English. Let's start with the second, the English one, because that's easier. The Rambam, in his Mora Nevuchim, in the Guide to the Perplexed, he has to deal with the Akedah. And he says, I'm starting with the English and then we'll go back to the Hebrew. Sources. The fact that Avram obeyed God and demonstrated his absolute certainty that had he received true prophecy. So according to the Rambam, the whole purpose of the Akedah is to teach us that prophecy exists. How do I know that prophecy exists? Because if Avram thought the message wasn't clear, if he wasn't sure, he would never have done it. By the fact that he does it, indicates that he must have heard very clearly and understood what God wanted. If it was a dream of prophecy, if it had been obscure for the prophets, if they had any doubts concerning what they heard, he never would have gone through with it. So according to the Rambam, the whole story is there to teach you prophecy exists, it's real, and the prophet understands it in an ultimate way. And just though you should see it, if you continue into source number seven, the Gemara in Sanhedrin uses the story of the Akedah to prove something called Hora'at Sha'ah. Hora'at Sha'ah is where a prophet comes along and says, we're going to do something different than the accepted. And one of the most common examples is Eliyahu brings a karban on Har HaKarmel when the Beit HaMikdash is standing. You should not be allowed to do that. But because he's Eliyahu, he's allowed to do it. And the Gemara says, but how do we know that Nevi'im have the ability to do this? Because of Avraham at the Akedah. So that is Rambam answer number one. Rambam answer number two, and I'll just read the underlines of the Hebrew for lack of time. The Rambam says, back in source 6, that the whole purpose of the story, Ella Kideshi and U Bnei Adam Shetzarich Lahem La'asoto, that this is not about Avraham and this is not about God, but this is about future generations, Sheyil Midu Mimenu, that they should learn from this story, Kalal Shnei Inyanim Gedolim. This whole story includes two major ideas. The one is about the prophecy, and the second one, and this becomes the underline, the first long underline in the middle of the paragraph, Lehodia, to let you know, Otanu Gvul Ahavat Hashem V'yirato Ad Hechan Hi Megad, to tell you the extent that a human being can go to for his love of God. And that Avraham, God put Avraham in a situation like this, Bidyuk, so Avraham could be that role model, so that people would understand to what extent you can go to because of your love of God. This takes it out of the moral question. Understand? Rambam isn't discussing whether God wants you to moral or not. Rambam says this whole story comes to teach you what that's why I call it a different message altogether. Message number one is the extent of prophecy. Message number two is how far a human being can go to for his love for God. And if you look at source number eight, I think you'll see something interesting. Source number eight is Rabbi Sacks. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, has a very interesting approach. He says the story is to teach us something completely different. He says, what God was doing when he asked Avram to offer up his son was not requesting a child sacrifice, but something quite different. He wanted Avraham to renounce ownership of his son. He wanted to establish a non-negotiable principle of Jewish law that children are not the property of their parents. He says, couldn't he have done that in another way? Okay. What's fascinating about this is that it's a completely different approach here, that he says that what God is asking Avram to do is in order to give the readers messages, whether it's the Rambam, whether it's Rabbi Sacks, and it's a completely different way. It's sort of, again, it's skirting the moral question. The next answer I want to give is the one that was alluded to here earlier, and that is that Avraham misunderstood the command, or Avraham was actually wrong. Buber, Martin Buber, comes along and says the Akedah, the challenge of the Akedah, was that God commanded him to do something immoral, and Avram was supposed to come along like he did in Sodom. He was supposed to come along and say, no, you can't, you know, I'm not going to do this, God. And the fact that he didn't is a problem in Avraham's. Immanuel Kant says the same idea, that Avraham should have failed when he does not, he should have refused. Now stay with me here. Eli Wiesel says that, like this, Avraham knew that he was supposed to argue and that God would say fine. Avraham decides as if to say, oh God, you want me to go through this? Watch, I'm going to do it. And then what's God going to do? He's as if, right, Eli Wiesel switches around. Now, Eli Wiesel can say things that the normal reader can't get away with because of his experiences, that you're not judging it. But it's fascinating that he sort of even says that he goes back to that originally happy ending story, but he says that God thought that Avram was going to argue, and when Avram doesn't argue, but that's what's the difficult problem with that? Is how do you say that God doesn't know the way Avram is going to... But it's a whole different approach. And what's the problem with this approach? That's saying that Avraham failed. There are two problems with this approach. Problem number one is it doesn't deal with the moral question. Still, you don't ask somebody something immoral. Secondly, we all know the Pirkei Avot, we all look at Avraham as being someone who passed 10 tests. How do you come along all of a sudden and say he doesn't?
Maybe he could have passed either way.
Perhaps.
Maybe he didn't argue because he already argued once and he saw that God was...
But that God had given in there.
We'll talk about it.
Another answer, which is difficult for us to accept, but I wanted you to see it because it is found in the commentators, is mostly by the Rashbam in Source 13. In Source 13, the Rashbam tells us, you became proud of your son, and I gave you and made a covenant with the Plishtim. Right? What happens right before Perikof Bet is Avram makes a three-generational covenant with the Plishtim. So according to the Rashbam says, God is mad at him for making the covenant. So God says to him, you made a covenant for three generations? Yeah. Now go and make a burnt offering and let's see what happens with your covenant. What's the Rashbam saying? Give it the real word. That the Akedah is a punishment. The Rashbam is saying that the Akedah is a punishment. And if you have in source number 15, and for lack of time I'm not going to read it, but source number 15 also discusses the Akedah as a punishment. How many of that sits well with you guys? No.
The whole thing doesn't sit well.
Does it sit well with you that this is a punishment?
No.
Because he made this three generational agreement with the Philistines, God says to him, "You were wrong."
What's the covenant?
That for 3 years we won't attack each other for three generations. The land, we're going to have a peace agreement.
And why does God say that?
Because God wants to give him the land and you're making an agreement with the guys who live there. Okay? Again, I don't think people are comfortable with this. And with the last time remaining, I want to suggest to you perhaps a different reading, which is a combination of many of these, which is my own, and you're free to disagree. I want to actually suggest that the whole understanding of this chapter, it needs to be understood with a overlooked personality in this chapter. And that overlooked personality is the ram. Is the ram. Look at source number, look at source number 14. Source number 14 is a Mishnah from Pirkei Avot that you know, that there were 10 things that were created on the twilight between Erev Shabbat. Right before God created the world, and right before he was finished creating, there were 10 miraculous creations that he made. The mouth of the earth that swallowed up Korach, the mouth of the Be'er Miriam, Bilam's donkey, the rainbow, the man, the staff, the shamir that cut the rock at the Beit HaMikdash, writing, especially on the one on the Luchot that you were able to read from both sides, the inscription of the tablets, some say the burial place of Moshe, and the ram of our father Avraham. Now, why would a ram, I understand a traveling well, you know, rainbow, donkeys that talk, like that I understand is a miraculous thing that needs to be created, you know, into creation. What is it about the ram of Avraham that God had to create it on right before Shabbos? Now let me make another point to you that many of you not realized. What date of the calendar was the ram created? No, it was Shabbos. But I want the calendar date. When did God create Adam? What was the Hebrew calendar date? Rosh Hashanah, you know that. God started creating the world the 25th day of Elul, and so that the creation of man is on Rosh Hashanah. Right? And that's one of the reasons we have Rosh Hashanah. So this ram, if it gets created right before Shabbat, it means it's been being created after Adam and Chava. It means that it's being created on Rosh Hashanah after the sin of Adam and Chava. Okay? Now, all of a sudden, God tells Avraham, take your son, bring him up for a sacrifice. Avraham puts him on the altar, and then God says to him, don't slaughter him. He looks up, and there is a replacement for his son Yitzhak, easily accessible to Avraham. He doesn't have to go catch him even. He's caught in the thorns. The ram showing up just then should be looked at as a miracle. This ram that was created during creation and was planned, which means that God planned it since the beginning of the world, which means to me, at least, that this whole Akedah story has been planned since the very beginning. And by putting the ram at creation, then it's telling us that this is part of the plan. Why? Because what does the ram give us? It gives us the shofar, right? Why do we specifically blow the shofar of the ayal? In order to give us forgiveness. The fact that you can wipe out something that you did is nothing short of miraculous. You did it already. How can you wipe it out? The concept of tshuva is miraculous. There's no other explanation for it. But how does it all work? It all works from this coming out of God creating the world with the ability to do tshuva. God gives humanity a tool through the Akedah so that we too can experience this miraculous form of redemption. Avraham, during the Akedah, overcomes the limits of human ability, resources. What does tshuva do? tshuva allows us to overcome our past, to overcome our feelings, to do something that's outside of the norm. The Akedah is outside the norm. God then allows us to do something that is outside the norm. Avram and Sarah, according to the norm, should not have had children. Yitzchak's birth is miraculous. The existence of the Jewish people to this day is miraculous. And our ram, by the way, doesn't disappear at the Akedah. When does the ram appear again? Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa says, the ram that was created, you don't have it, I'm sorry, that was created at the twilight of the sixth day of creation, every single thing had a purpose. The ashes were the foundation of the altar. The veins were the 10 strings on the harp of David. The hide became the cloak of Eliyahu. The two horns were made into shofarot. One was blown at Har Sinai, and the next horn is going to be blown when Mashiach comes. So the ram, as I'm trying to say to you, is part of the most unsung personality in our chapter. But what the ram does is that it's now equating the Akedah to many to tshuva and to all kinds of events in the future. We're running out of time, but just quickly, what's the parallel between the Akedah and Matan Torah? Quickly, just think of things off the top of your head. Both stories occur on a mountaintop. Both occur on an unknown land. Both there are clouds covering that mountaintop. Both of them occur on the third day, right? And both of them talk about the acceptance of God in this world, first as an individual and then as a nation. That's why the expression, now I know that you are God-fearing, and it becomes, according to Rav Neventhal, the reason the Jews are able to accept the Torah. God went to the other nations and said, accept the Torah. The normal thing to say is, no thanks. Just the way Avram goes beyond the norm, just the way Tshuva is beyond the norm, accepting the Torah is beyond the norm, and all of these things are created. And perhaps this whole lesson of the Akedah, first of all, is that this was part, and this comes back to, remember I told you the happy ending, that when God creates the ram at the beginning of creation, that this whole Akedah story is part of a plan that starts at creation, goes through the Akedah, goes through Matan Torah, and is going to end up at Mashiach. I might not understand the nuances, I might not understand the parallelisms, but what I do come out is that there is a plan, and that's perhaps why Avram doesn't pray. That's why, because he realizes that he's part of something larger than himself.